Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the University Professors Program, the Humanities Foundation at Boston University, and the literary journal AGNI. Speaking will be Polish poet, novelist, and essayist Adam Zagajewski. Introducing Mr. Zagajewski is Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
We are very, very happy to have Adam Zagajewski here. Adam Zagajewski is one of the best-loved Polish poets, loved not only in Poland, but also in the United States and in other countries. He was born in 1945 in the city of Lwów, and he grew up in Gliwice, and then he studied in Kraków, which is the city in which he is residing right now. In the meantime, he also had a short exile stint in Paris. He will be reading some poems. I'm not going to take too much of your time before his reading. I just wanted to read the titles of the books that have been published in English. There is a book, A Defense of Ardor. This is the latest, yes, published, which is a book of essays, and it's published in, was published here in 2004. Mysticism for Beginners in 1997, Tremor in 1995, and Canvas in 1991. He's also wrote the volume Another Beauty, which is part memoir and part thoughts about poetry. And also other two volumes were published, one, Two Cities, and then Solitude and Solidarity, a volume of essays in 1990. Thank you. Welcome. And please come on.
Good evening. I'll start maybe with a poem from the book. I have plenty of new poems because a year from now there will be a new volume published by Farah Strauss-Giroux. I'll start with a poem that's called, the title is Watching Shoah in a Hotel Room in America. Shoah is the documentary, of course, by Claude Lanzmann. There are nights as soft as fur on a foal, but we prefer chess or card playing. Here, some hotel guests sing Happy Birthday as the one-eyed TV nonchalantly shuffles its images. The trees of my childhood have crossed an ocean to greet me coolly from the screen. Polish peasants engage with a Jesuitical zest in theological disputes. Only the Jews are silent, exhausted by their long dying. The rivers of the voyages of my youth flow cautiously over the distant, unfamiliar continent. Hay wagons haul not hay but her, their axles squeaking under the feathery weight. We are innocent, the pines claim. The SS officers are haggard and old. Doctors struggle to save them their hearts, lives, consciences. It's late. The insinuations of drowsiness have me. I'll sleep, but my neighbors choir Happy Birthday still louder, louder than the dying Jews. Huge trucks transport stars from the firmament. Gloomy trains go by in the rain. I'm innocent, Mozart repents. Only the aspen, as usual, trembles, prepared to confess all its crimes. The Czech Jews sing the national anthem. Where is my home? There's no home. Houses burn. the cold gas whistles within. I grow more and more innocent, sleepy. The TV reassures me both of us are beyond suspicion. The birthday is noisier. The shoes of Auschwitz in pyramids high as the sky groan faintly. Alas, we outlived mankind. Now let us sleep, sleep. We have nowhere to go. Irena asked me to read this poem, try to praise the mutilated world, which I would usually avoid. Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watched the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world and the gray feather at thrash lost and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns. And now I'll switch to newer poems in a second. This poem is called Sunrise of a Cassis, and Cassis is a town in southern France. Very good swimming there. It's on the coast. Sunrise over Cassis. In the semi-darkness, white buildings loom, not fully formulated, and beside them the great vineyards, the quiet before dawn. Judas counts his silver coins, but olive trees contorted in wild prayer enter the earth ever more deeply. Where is the sun? But it's still cold, and a humble landscape spreads around us. The stars have gone and priests sleep tight. Birds aren't allowed to sing in August. And only now and then one stammers like a lazy boy in high school Latin. It's 4 a.m. and despair lives in so many houses. This is the time when sad philosophers with narrow faces compose their jaded aphorisms and warn conductors who'd brought Bruckner and Mahler back to life that evening drift off to sleep, unwilling, unapplauded, and whores go home to their shabby apartments. We ask that the vineyards, gray as if coated with volcanic ash, be given life, and that the great distant cities awaken from their apathy. And I ask not to confuse freedom with chaos, and to regain the faith that unites things seen and unseen, but doesn't lull the heart. Beneath us, the sea turns blue, and the horizon's line grows ever finer, like a slender fillet that embraces lovingly and firmly our turning planet. And we see fishing boats rock trustfully like gulls upon the deep blue waters, and a moment later the sun's crimson disk emerges from a half circle of hills and returns the gift of light. Now I read some of the newer poems, some of them still unpublished, at least in this language. This is a poem that it's called Epithalamium. Without silence, there would be no music. Life, paired, is doubtless more difficult than solitary existence. Just as a boat on the open sea with outstretched sails is trickier to steer than the same boat drowsing at a dock. But schooners, after all, are meant for wind and motion, not idleness and impassive quiet. A conversation continued through the years includes hours of anxiety, anger, even hatred, but also compassion, deep feeling. Only in marriage do love and time, eternal enemies, join forces. Only love and time, when reconciled, permit us to see other beings in their enigmatic, complex essence, unfolding slowly and certainly, like a new settlement in a valley or among green hills. It begins from one day only, from joy and pledges, from the holy day of meeting, which is like a moist grain. Then come the years of trial and labor, sometimes despair, fierce revelation, happiness, and finally a great tree with rich greenery grows over us, casting its vast shadow. Cares vanish in it. I'm told it's too optimistic, but this is a poem for Joseph Brodsky, which was published in a magazine recently. The title is Subject Brodsky. Please note, born in May in a damp city, hence the motif, water. Soon to be surrounded by an army whose officers kept Hölderlin in their backpacks, but alas, had no time for reading. Too much to do. Tone sardonic, despair authentic, always en route from Mexico to Venice, lover and crusader who campaigned ceaselessly for his unlikely party, name Poetry Versus the Infinite, or PVI if you prefer abbreviations. In every city and in every port, he had his agents. He sometimes sang his poems before an avid crowd that didn't catch a word. Afterwards, exhausted, he would smoke a Gauloise on a cement embankment, gulls circling overhead as if above the Baltic back home. Vast intelligence. Favorite topic, time versus thought, which chases phantoms, revives Mary Stuart, Daedalus, Tiberius. Poetry should be like horse racing, wild horses with jockeys made of marble, an unseen finish line hidden in the clouds. Please remember, irony and pain. The pain had lived long inside his heart and kept on growing, as though each elegy he wrote adored him obsessively and wanted him alone to be its hero. But, ladies and gentlemen, your patience, please, we are nearly through. I don't know quite how to put it. Something like tenderness, the almost timid smile, the momentary doubt, the hesitation, the tiny pause in flawless arguments. music heard with you. Music heard with you will stay with us always. Grave Brahms and elegiac Schubert, a few songs, Chopin's fourth ballad, a couple of quartets with heartbreaking chords, Beethoven, adagios, the sadness of Shostakovich who didn't want to die, the great choruses of Bach's passions as if someone had summoned us, demanding joy, pure and impartial, joy in which faith is self-evident. Some scraps of Lutosławski as fleeting as our thoughts. A black woman singing blues ran through us like shining steel, though it reached us on the street of an ugly, dirty town. Mahler's endless marches, the trumpet's voice that opens the Fifth Symphony and the first part of the Ninth. You sometimes call him Mahler. Mozart's despair in the Requiem, his buoyant piano concertos. You hummed them better than I did, but we both know that. Music heard with you will grow still with us. This poem is called Old Marx. Maybe you still remember who Karl Marx was. He can't think. London is damp. In every room someone coughs. He never did like winter. He rewrites past manuscripts time and again without passion. The yellow paper is fragile as consumption. Why does life race stubbornly toward destruction? But spring returns in dreams with snow that doesn't speak in any known tongue. And where does love fit within his system? Where you find blue flowers? He despises anarchists. Idealists bore him. He receives reports from Russia, far too detailed. The French grow rich. Poland is common and quiet. America never stops growing. Blood is everywhere. Perhaps the wallpaper needs changing. He begins to suspect that poor humankind will always trudge across the old earth like the local lunatic shaking her fists at an unseen god. Now, this is a very short poem called Defending Poetry, etc. Yes, defending poetry, high style, etc. But also summer evenings in a small town where gardens waft and cats sit quietly on doorsteps like Chinese philosophers. Okay, I'll read the second poem on Old Marx. Old Marx 2. I try to envision his last winter, London, cold and damp, the snow's curt kisses on empty streets, the Thames' black water, chilled prostitutes lit bonfires in the park. Vast locomotives sobbed somewhere in the night. The workers spoke so quickly in the pub that he couldn't catch a word. Perhaps Europe was richer and at peace, but the Belgians still tormented the Congo. And Russia, its tyranny, Siberia. He spent evenings staring at the shutters. He couldn't concentrate, rewrote old work, reread young Marx for days on end, and secretly admired that ambitious author. He still had faith in his fantastic vision, but in moments of doubt, he worried that he'd given the world only a new version of despair. Then he would close his eyes and see nothing but the scarlet darkness of his lids. I'll read something light and optimistic now. This is a short sequence of short poems. It's called En Route and has 14 very short sections. One, without baggage. To travel without baggage, sleep in the train on a hard wooden bench, forget your native land, emerge from small stations at dawn when a gray sky rises and fishing boats head to sea. Two, in Belgium. It was drizzling in Belgium and the river wound between hills. I thought I am so imperfect. The trees sat in the meadows like priests in green cassocks. October was hiding in the weeds. No, ma'am, I said, this is the non-talking compartment. Three, a hawk circles above the highway. It will be disappointed if it swoops down on sheet iron, on gas, on a tape of tawdry music on our narrow hearts. Mont Blanc. It shines from afar, white and cautious, like a lantern for shadows. Five, Segesta. On the meadow, a vast temple, a wild animal open to the sky. Six, Summer. Summer was gigantic, triumphant, and our little car looked lost on a road going to Verdun. Seven, the station in Bitton. Bitton is the ugliest city in Eastern Europe. It's an industrial city in Silesia. In the underground tunnel, cigarette butts grow, not daisies. It stinks of loneliness. Eight, retired people on a field trip. They are learning to walk on land. Nine, goals. Eternity doesn't travel, eternity waits. In a fishing port, only the gulls like to chat. 10. The theater in Taormina. From the theater in Taormina, you can see the snow on Etna's peak and the gleaming sea. Which is the better actor? 11. A black cat. A black cat comes out to greet us as if to say, look at me and not some old Romanesque church. I am alive. 12. A Romanesque church. At the bottom of the valley, a Romanesque church is resting. There is wine in this cask. 13. Light. Light on the walls of old houses. June. Passerby, open your eyes. 14. At dawn. The world's materiality at dawn and the soul's frailty. Another Sicilian poem, this one is called Syracuse. City with the loveliest name, Syracuse. Don't let me forget the dim antiquity of your side streets, the pouting balconies that once caged Spanish ladies, the way the sea breaks on Ortigia's walls. Plato met defeat here, escaped with his life. What can be said about us, unreal tourists? Your cathedral rose atop a Greek temple and still grows, but very slowly, like the heavy pleas of beggars and widows. At midnight, fishing boats radiate sharp light, demanding prayers for the perished, the lonely. For you, city, abandoned on a continent's rim, and for us, imprisoned in our travels. This is a poem I've never read yet. I sort of Not publicly. I have read it when I wrote it, of course. It's called, the title is Life is Not a Dream. And it's meant as a kind of short history of, I don't know, of my generation, maybe. Life is not a dream. I name here a street, Coldwater Street. This was in this city where I grew up, in this strange place called Gliwice in Silesia. In the beginning, freezing nights and hatred. Red Army soldiers fired automatic pistols at the sky, trying to strike the highest being. Mother cried, perhaps remembering the sentimental stories of her childhood. Coldwater Street ran beside the river as if trying to outrace it or to reach its distant sources, still pure beyond a doubt, recalling the dawn's joy. If life is a dream, then the phoenix may actually exist. But in Krakow, life revived under the sign of common pigeons. In the Planty Gardens, alongside veterans clad in the tattered uniforms of at least three armies, young beauties put in appearances, and music-loving plane trees donned their finest new foliage outside Symphony Hall. Should one honor local gods? A beggar at the marketplace in Lucca moved from stand to stand, garnering tributes, proud as Diana. It's more difficult to find nymphs where we live, though, and Great Pan didn't leave his calling card. Important memories, stern monuments to monotheism, were inscribed only in the trees and on church walls. We tried courage since there was no exit. We tried cunning, but it failed. We tried patience and fell asleep. We wrote poems like leaflets, and leaflets like pages from burgeoning epics. Dreams grew like hibiscus flowers. Dark wells opened in the night. We tried cynicism. Some of us succeeded. There was great joy, don't forget. We tried time. It was tasteless like water. Finally, much later, for unknown reasons, the clocks began to revolve ever faster above us, as in archival silent films. And life went on, inevitable life, so skeptical, so practiced, coming back to us so insistently that one day we felt the taste of ordinary failure, of common tragedy upon our lips, which was a kind of triumph. And I end with a slightly older poem from the book. It's called Self-Portrait. Self-Portrait. Between the computer, a pencil, and a typewriter, half my day passes. One day, it will be half a century. I live in strange cities and sometimes talk with strangers about matters strange to me. I listen to music a lot. Bach, Mahler, Chopin, Shostakovich. I see three elements in music: weakness, power, and pain. The fourth has no name. I read poets, living and dead, who teach me tenacity, faith, and pride. I try to understand the great philosophers, but actually catch just scraps of their precious thoughts. I like to take long walks on Paris streets and watch my fellow creatures quickened by envy, anger, desire. To trace a silver coin passing from hand to hand as it slowly loses its round shape, the emperor's profile is erased. beside me trees expressing nothing but a green, indifferent perfection. Black birds pace the fields waiting patiently like Spanish widows. I'm no longer young, but someone else is always older. I like deep sleep when I cease to exist, and fast bike rides on country roads when poplars and houses dissolve like cumuli on sunny days. Sometimes in museums the paintings speak to me and irony suddenly vanishes. I laugh gazing at my wife's face. Every Sunday I call my father. Every other week I meet with friends, thus proving my fidelity. My country freed itself from one evil. I wish another liberation would follow. Could I help in this? I don't know. I'm truly not a child of the ocean, as Antonio Machado wrote about himself, but a child of air, mint, and cello, and not all the ways of the high world cross paths with the life that so far belongs to me. Thank you.
So thank you very much. And maybe we should start with this first issue, that is the issue of why I ask you to try to praise the mutilated world. And we made the postcard, as you have seen, with the image of the towers, because this was, as many of you know, a poem that has been published by the New Yorker in the first issue that came after September 11, and the cover was black on black, the towers on the black background. And when we were making this postcard, we of course tried to reach as many people, somehow awake people's memory about this poem, because we assume that you are known by it. On the other hand, we were a little bit worried that you may feel a little bit pigeonholed by it. That is, what does it? How do you feel? What does it mean for you that you have been associated to this very concrete historical moment, and that the poem that you wrote before that, and which was not about that, became so attached to this very concrete moment?
Well, frankly, it's a relief, because there's another poem that I'm always afraid somebody will ask me to read, which is To Go to Lvov, which many of my friends consider my best poem, and they always look at me condescendingly and say, "We'll never write anything like this again." So having now this poem try to praise the mutilated world is a relief, because at least I feel like there are two poems that I don't need to read. It's simple. It's a simple phenomenon, because indeed sometimes people ask me to read this poem in this country, not so much in other countries. And I usually do it, but it's a very simple mechanical reaction. If you read too much one single poem, I think poets try to read different poems. They feel like landowners who have many kinds. They have a forest, they have a meadow, they have a river. So they want to display everything, not just always the same barn. And it's I think it's as simple as that. The fear of redundancy, that you read always the same poem. But I actually like this poem. There's nothing wrong with it.
This poem is a poem that impressed many people a lot and somehow felt like a good poem for that particular occasion, because it's one of your poems that is closer to one of the closest to prayer. And you wrote in another beauty that you wrote in third person about a young poet who, while praying, suddenly realizes that in order to pray, he doesn't have to repeat the words of the prayer, that he can compose his own words. And is your poetry writing, besides other things, is this related to prayer? And is this, in a certain way, civil religion?
Well, that's a tricky question. When I was a child, when you grew up in Poland under a communist government, your real teachers were priests, not so much communists, because the church was so powerful and the catechism. For me, I really remember what I wrote in Another Beauty. What's a revelation for me that prayers? I always thought that prayers are written for eternity and they're in these black books that you get from your priest. And later on, I understood you can pray with your own words, which is actually a dangerous moment for the church, because this is how mystics are being born. You know, and once they understand that they don't need to comply with the written word, but the printed word printed by the church. A schism is very near. So it's, in theory, you can pray with your own words, but it's not commendable. So the church doesn't like it. But I think a part of my poems are, a small part of is like prayer. I don't think it's the only form. It's a very difficult question. I think that poetry is a combination of intelligence and magic, and the proportions between the two vary. I like that this. I quoted it in one of my essays. This definition that Eugenio Montale quotes from a 17th century Italian Jesuit who said that poetry is a dream dreamed in the presence of reason. It's a very beautiful definition. And you could revert it. You could say that poetry is a discourse in the presence of dream. And you never know what's these two main ingredients of poetry, intelligence, discourse, the knowledge of the world, something that's completely rational. And because poets should not be stupid, I think, to some extent, but not too much. And yet poetry is not discourse. It goes beyond this. Poetry exists for a few magical moments that happen sometimes. And poetry without those short magical moments is not poetry. You need those. And these magical moments put poetry beyond a rational sphere. It's still somehow rational. It's written, it's printed, there are critics who review it and destroy it or not. So it's in the realm of the rational, more or less. It's not invisible, it's on the page. But I deeply believe that the reason, the raison d'etre of poetry is in those magical, short moments that sometimes maybe happen in one poem or two poems, and that they bring about something that's close to the religious moment, not completely, not identical. So I think poets are like heretics. They're religious people, or at least the poet as I understand it, but they don't belong to any church. So in my private life, I am sort of a bad Catholic. I don't go to the church because Polish priests are not my favorite people. They're either pedophiles or anti-Semites or or former collaborators of the secret police, plus, but there's some good ones too. I shouldn't go too far in this. No, I know some very decent priests as well. But so the church as a social institution, I look at it very skeptically. And I think if you're a pod, it's like you're a one-person church, because you establish a new church, which is your poetry. But the connection between religion and poetry is incredibly difficult to define. And that's completely different at the same time. It's not religion. Poetry is not religion. And yet this magical element, this moment of something else, puts poetry near religion somehow.
And the kind of a third element in this situation of reading your poem that try to praise the mutilated word is the political element. We have been talking about it the previous time that Adam was here at Boston University. There was this encounter in which there were three poets, and all three of them came from an imperial situation, but each of these imperial situations was different. That Robert Pinsky was from the live and kicking American Empire, and his main issue that he was talking about was about democracy. Is it possible for an empire to be also a republic? Derek Walcott was talking about his gratitude towards Shakespeare that the empire somehow left him as an inheritance the access to English language. And Adam then was talking about his beginnings of him as a poet who was fighting against the state, saying that the state in the Soviet bloc in which he was growing up was also wanted to be a poet. So that the poets were, in a certain way, in competition. They wanted to unseat the state. And then it seemed that the politics was somehow receded. And that the situation after 1989, the change of regime in Poland, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the inclusion of Poland and East Central European countries into European Union, turned the issue of politics, took the magic out of it in a certain way. It was not to be, because what the poets were, the poets you were interested in and yourself, they were interested in dissident politics, not politics in a certain way as parliamentarian politics or everyday, boring, democratic politics. But now that there is a real deterioration in politics of that region, in that that is, in a certain way, the return to populism and big conflict, tensions, and very anti-intellectual attitudes on the part of these several of these new governments. Do you feel that your role as a poet changes in this situation?
Well, the answer is, again, very difficult and complex. I think for a poet, the main difference when he or she deals with political systems is the difference between totalitarianism and everything else, and a sort of democratic government. And the totalitarianism, when it's such a huge thing that it's very hard to be an aesthete under totalitarian government, to write about flowers and birds and, you know, or being a language poet and under totalitarian. It's very hard to say why, but it's just, it feels like betrayal. If, you know, if nothing, you're not allowed to say anything humane, if you cannot criticize the inhuman law or the inhuman practice of the law, and you are in your office and you write you write a sonnet after sonnet, and you don't pay any attention. This, it's very hard to say theoretically why, but it seems very bizarre and unpleasant almost, to, as if you had to say something, because language changes under totalitarianism. Language is being confiscated by the government. And I remember I quoted 2 years ago, my one of my friends wrote a poem that had a title, Polish, the greatest Polish poet is the state. And this was the feeling among the poets, that the state, the government, took place of poetry, that had a monopoly for language. And if you just write innocent sonnets in such a time, these sonnets don't sound very well because they sound hollow. It seems that you have to do something about the confiscation of language. So, but then after 89 and even before, because it's also, it's, well, I don't want to, you know, it's not a lecture on totalitarianism. I'm not Adam Michnik either. but it changes also once because there are so many stages in the development of a totalitarian system. There are moments or stages when it has some intellectual credence about it. Like the Soviet Union in the 20s, it seemed like that there was something invincible and maybe very attractive about the totalitarian communism then, but it. Time makes the totalitarians look shabbier and shabbier with every decade. And after a while, in this last decade, it has no intellectual dress. It's naked. It's just naked force. So it's a huge difference between being a poet or an artist in the first stage and in the last stage, when it's not really difficult to see through the pretenses of totalitarianism. But then everything changes with the collapse when the democratic system comes. I think it's completely different. You can go back to your study and write sonnets, provided they are good. But because it's so hard, I think the real limit is if you know the date of the next election, then writing angry poems against your government is problematic because they will be obsolete after, you know, 2 years. And so you're just writing a poem for 2 years or three or one. And that's a very unpleasant situation because we all dream of eternity, of course. We want to write a poem forever and not for 2 years. And in my country, it is a populist government, which irritates me immensely. But I still know the date of the next election. If they will abolish elections, I will tell you what I will do. But so far they haven't. And it's a difference between being irritated and being persecuted or being taken the language away. They didn't take my language away. I don't like them too much, and I wonder whether under the previous government, it seemed to me that there was this huge issue of corruption because those new democracies in the East, they're pretty corrupted. It's a huge problem, and I was asked once in Krakow to be a judge of a poetry contest and to propose a theme for this poetry. It was for the amateur poets, and I was curious whether somebody could write a poem on corruption. So I proposed the theme corruption for, and actually there was one good poem among these poems, but the winner never came to get the prize. It was, so, I don't know why. So that's the basic difference, and between irritation and persecution.
Yeah, your two poems about old Marx are an indication of somehow very contemplative attitude towards politics. And it is unimaginable about 15 years ago, or maybe 20 years ago, to have such an... I don't know when you wrote it, by the way.
2 years ago.
2 years ago, yes. That it would be unimaginable to have Marx in such a, in a certain way, contemplative, approach him as a... as a sad person, sad, irritated, or rather than you know, the word Marx already was making people stand in a certain way alert. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's right. I think I haven't thought about that. It's true.
Mm-hmm. And it was completely. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture by Polish poet, novelist, and essayist Adam Zagajewski. Tonight's lecture was sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the University Professors Program, the Humanities Foundation at Boston University, and the literary journal AGNI. Mr. Zagajewski was introduced by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoog, with help from Matt Odette and Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.